The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
We're joined by Helen Vaughan and also by Michael Cogley from the Ireland edition of The Times. And Helen, if you could start, what is the latest in relation to the London bombing? Fortunately, it seems no fatalities.
Well, it seems like it didn't explode properly from what I can gather. But basically, this homemade bomb exploded on a packed commuter train this morning at around 20 past 8, which is obviously a very busy time in morning traffic. 22 people were injured. It sounds horrific. Like, it sounds like people were literally just running for their lives but couldn't get away. There was a stampede. A lot of people injured as a result of that. It happened at the Parsons Green Underground Station, which is in West London, at a very, very busy time. I think the train was just coming in to stop, and then there were hundreds of people obviously on the platform as well. They're calling it a terror attack, and there are photos circulating of this improvised device, which looks like a bucket in a bag with some wires hanging out. It looks really unsophisticated. I'm no security expert by any stretch, but to me it looks really unsophisticated.
What sort of injuries is it known, Michael, that people experience as a result of this?
Well, there's been nothing serious reported so far, but the bomb itself was reported as kind of a huge fireball that was sent down essentially the tram line itself and passengers walking by. So it must have been, you know, a terrifying experience for all involved. But as far as I understand, there have been no serious injuries sustained so far. There's been, I suppose, kind of condolences sent out to people who have been injured thus far, but they haven't been as serious as previous attacks.
Yeah, I think it's like flash burns. It's been a description of much of the injuries. Have the London Metropolitan Police given any indication as to who they may think is responsible?
I don't think as early as our friend Donald Trump has said. I think he's alleged that some of the an ISIS terrorist group style attack, it certainly seems a lot less sophisticated than the attacks we've seen in the past, but Donald Trump seems to have information different to what the Metropolitan Police has suggested so far.
Well, indeed, because his tweet today was, another attack in London by a loser terrorist. These are sick and demented people who were in the sights of Scotland Yard. Must be proactive. In the sights of Scotland Yard would suggest that he had been told that they had information as to some sort of attack.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. I mean, it's hard to know what kind of information he had, but that's certainly what he's suggesting there anyway.
But the British Prime Minister Theresa May is not happy with that, apparently, Helen.
But didn't this happen after Manchester as well, where he was giving out, was it that incident where Donald Trump was giving out information, security information that wasn't public yet, that police in the UK were unhappy about? And I don't know if it's him getting briefs, as he does, as one of the most powerful people in the world, and he doesn't know what's private information and what's public information, that he's saying too much all the time, or is he not very smart that he just seems to say the wrong thing and annoy other world leaders like Theresa May, which is fair enough. If they're not saying that much yet, you know, and he is from the other side of the world.
Let's move on. And one of the more controversial stories of the week has related to comments made by the News Talk broadcaster George Hook on his programme last Friday lunchtime. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, was asked about it on RTÉ's Morning Ireland today.
Well, look, first of all, I strongly disagree with the comments that he made. Nobody who is raped or sexually assaulted is ever responsible for that in any way. So I totally disagree with and abhor the comments that he made. He has since then, of course, apologised profusely. And I think he does understand that what he said about this issue and on that occasion and also in the past was unacceptable.
What does it tell us, maybe, about attitudes towards rape and towards the victims of rape?
Well, I think it's indicative of attitudes that still exist in Irish society that need to change.
That was from Morning Ireland on RTÉ Radio 1 this morning. Then, about an hour later, just after 9 o'clock, News Talk issued a statement, Helen Vaughan. What was in that statement?
Well, basically, they've come to a decision. They basically confirmed that he's been suspended from his duties at the station and the process regarding his comments last week is ongoing. They had announced an internal review earlier in the week, so I'm not sure why they've decided to suspend him now and not at the start of the week. Is it because the Taoiseach has weighed in on it, or is it because advertisers are pulling out? And they've had two major advertisers pull out during the week from this particular show. And maybe it's, you know, because there's been lots of talk about it. There's been lots of Twitter hype about it. Some people are saying that people are reacting too harshly against him. I sort of think you can't be on national radio if you have opinions like that and you feel free to voice them against women and victims of sexual abuse.
What's your view on this, Michael Coghlan?
Yeah, I think News Talk's response to it has been criticised as being reactionary, much like the response on Twitter. People are kind of reacting to it and that kind of thing. But I believe what he said obviously was wrong and unacceptable and that kind of thing. But I think Leo Varadkar really kind of hit the nail on the head and said that it's indicative of attitudes that still exist in Irish society. So there is a serious debate around whether or not he should, you know, they should take further action. Should he continue to be sacked in the end or not? But I think if the attitudes are there, I think if he's removed from the airwaves and that kind of thing, you're probably silencing those attitudes rather than addressing them and kind of dealing with them in what a normal mature society would do and debate and correct if they're incorrect, which obviously in this case they are. And I think that's probably the more correct response to it.
It's not the first time, though, that we've had disagreements or arguments on national radio and the national discussion in relation to attitudes towards rape. Indeed, George Hook himself was at the very centre of one only 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was 2015. He dealt with those comments as well. And I think that's what we saw from News Talk's staff response to it. Was maybe there's a little bit more to play here than just the comments that he made last week. It was just, you know, it's a culmination of a number of incidents that he's gone to. But I mean, News Talk employed him to be on the line, to be, you know, as close to the line as possible. And they've taken the risk with this, I believe, in that some instances he may cross the line, he may not. And in this circumstance, they seem a bit all over the place in terms of their response.
There's a lot of comment on social media as well, Helen Vaughan, from people saying that he should not be silenced even if people disagree with the views he is expressing. But how many of those comments, and there's been quite a lot of vitriol online towards particularly women who have commented on this, how many of the people who are defending his right to free speech are actually defending and supporting what he said and subsequently apologised for?
Well, see, and that's the hard part here, is that you've got people with opinions on both sides, people who agree with what he said, albeit I think they're wrong, and people who disagree with what he said. But I just think maybe stronger action should have been taken sooner against him as a broadcaster for saying that. And I do think, yes, he said similar things in the past, but I think there's been a shift in society now where we are learning that you can't be misogynistic and you can't blame people who are the victims of sexual attacks for those sexual attacks. Women can't expect to be sexually assaulted at any moment if we get too drunk or if we go out on our own or if we walk home alone in the dark or whatever. You can't lay blame at the foot of the victim. And I think the problem is that a lot of victims blame themselves as well. And I do work as a psychotherapist as well. And, you know, children blame themselves for sexual abuse that happened when they were as young as 6 or 7. And we're trying to undo that. And that views like this just reinforce that. So it undoes a lot of the hard work that agencies and organisations are trying to do.
Okay, let's move on from that. And actually, let's move to the issue, Michael Coghlan. It was a report, I think, in the Irish Examiner this morning about how paedophiles are now posing on social media to try and lure school children. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a story from Gordon Deegan. He's maintaining that paedophiles, or he's not maintaining, but he's reported that paedophiles are setting up fake accounts, pretending to be things like chicken nuggets, ice creams, and even roads to kind of lure children in.
How would that work?
Well, the main thing is it's to go with something so innocuous like a chicken nugget or something, it's quite easy to friend. And maybe as a child you might look, oh, it's chicken nugget, there's nothing sinister behind it. But it's a good way from paedophile's perspective to get access to a child's photographs, to their shared albums and that kind of thing. And that seems to be the method that they've gone about. I think the example he gave in it was a road. Someone set up a Facebook page of a road that was on a girls' school, and then befriended 400 girls in that school. He didn't proceed to make any effort to kind of meet up with them or anything, but he just catch all on the photographs and went on from there. Maureen Griffin, a forensic psychologist that's quoted in it, warned the paedophiles have come up with new ways of gaining access to children's information, and this is the type of stuff that she's talking about.
That is quite frightening to think of, that something so innocent that children would react to is that they can get caught up by that.
Yeah, definitely, and it's raising a lot of new questions around, I suppose, how young children should have access to social media and phones and this kind of thing, and it's a brand new debate that we haven't had in the past.
Helen Vaughan, what do you make of that?
This really shocks me, I have to say, and I guess it's so simple, but it's so shocking. And you try to educate your children and don't befriend anyone you don't know, but don't befriend an ice cream. Kids like ice cream, see a photo on a Facebook profile, you know, they're going to click on it or they're going to befriend it. And, you know, one of the tips they give here, which I sort of think maybe is the only way to do it, that you need to be checking your children's friends on their social media accounts to see, do you and does your child know who all these people are, even if it's just a chicken nugget or a piece of ice cream? Because, you know, these sex offenders are pretending to be a road. That to me is just bizarre. But if you're school is on that road and everyone else becoming friendly with this profile, I guess you all jump on the bandwagon. But I don't know, do you just have to mine through your kids' social media accounts regularly to see what's in there and who's in there?
That's easier said than done, isn't it?
Because they won't let you.
Yes.
I don't know. What else do you do? Don't befriend anyone unless you know them. Because even then you can set up an account, pretend to be a child as has been known before, and you're not. You're a sex offender. You know, how do you protect against that? Get them off the internet altogether?
Some would argue that the responsibility should probably lie on the area of the social media sites themselves, the Facebooks, Twitters. What their reaction to it is generally kind of in response to something that's claimed, so something that breaks community standards. In my opinion, I think if they were to take on a proactive role to this, they should be looking at properly introducing identification to open an account. So if you're saying you are who you are, there needs to be kind of higher standards of confirmation of that fact when you are opening a Facebook page or a Twitter page.
And a phone number and an email address which you've verified and all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Although they're all easy to get around, so.
But I think maybe around, like, identification around, you know.
I don't want to give my passport to Facebook, though. No offense, I wouldn't do it.
No, I guess not. There's arguments to and from, but there definitely needs to be better confirmation of who you are online, I think.
Yeah.
We've covered before on this programme, but I think it seems to have reached an end. The lawsuit between the monkey and the photographer. Explain this one, Michael, for those who aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, this is an incredible story between a photographer, David Slater, who went out to an island called Sulawesi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I think it's just north of Australia in Indonesia. He basically followed a troop of monkeys for 3 days, put an awful lot of work in, I would imagine, and stayed in what he described as basic accommodation. And then he would, you know, he'd follow the monkeys for a couple of days, then go back to his accommodation, then use the guide to help him back. And he ended up leaving the camera set up on a tripod, and one of the monkeys, who are quite rare, took a selfie of himself, and it became iconic. It's a terrific photograph. I mean, it's brilliant. You've got the big smile, big red eyes. It's a really, really good picture, but it ended up being the subject of a very unusual lawsuit where people were arguing that the intellectual property of the photograph belonged to the monkey itself. Luckily enough, that's now come to an end. 75% of the money will stay with the photographer and 25% will go to protect. Sorry, I'll get this for you now.
Yeah, I think it is 25% going to animal welfare charities, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's where the money's going. So I'd say it's been a very frustrating couple of years for the photographer.
I think he wasn't making any money from the photograph for a long time, was trying to claim that he was in financial hardship as a result, whereas the PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, were trying to claim that the animal owned the rights to the photo. And that debate, I just think, seems kind of ridiculous because it was his gear. He set it up. I don't know if he taught them how to take a selfie, but he obviously did something to encourage them.
Hillary Clinton's new book, Helen, has not been getting good reviews on Amazon, but they're suspicious about that.
Well, apparently many of the one-star reviews, so I think 5-star means it's great, 1-star means not so great, have been deleted, allegedly, by Amazon. But if you read down through it, they claim, or a website that analyses the authenticity of Amazon reviews, says that apparently a quarter of the reviewers of her book were suspicious, meaning that, you know, if a reviewer only reviewed one title, i.e. this book, they delete them, I think, because they claim they're not an honest reviewer. Because if you were, you would be reviewing many books, not just one book. So I don't know if there are two sides to it.
Or could they have been Trump bots?
They definitely could have. Out of all the characters in America to attract negative publicity to her book without people having actually read it, I think Hillary Clinton would be one of the ones at the top of the list. But this is the problem with online ratings as well. You see it with new movies that come out on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes. They have massively high ratings after like the first week. They get into the 90s and all of a sudden they're the Godfather. And then week one, week two, week three, they start to gradually come down. So there's a lot of kind of... It's hard to tell just how concrete the ratings are, especially in this case. I mean, there's so many suspects.
So there's manipulation of these ratings. I mean, they were a great idea in theory to allow ordinary people to actually give their honest opinions, but it gets hijacked.
Yeah, it does. But it just takes some time. I think, generally speaking, a lot of the rating sites average out after a couple of weeks. And I think Amazon are probably doing the right thing here. If you've bought one book and reviewed one book in the past and your second one is Hillary Clinton's memoirs and you've decided to go to town on it, you probably are entitled to ask questions around their validity.
And you wonder, have they had time to read the book before writing the review as well? Let's hear a little bit though of Sean Spicer. Remember, let's all remember Sean Spicer, the wonderful press secretary in the Trump administration, much missed and lamented, I think, at this stage, given all the fun that he gave us in the few months he was in the job. He went on an interview on American television with Jimmy Kimmel during the week, and he was mocked about, remember the inauguration crowd size that Donald Trump boasted about, and Sean Spicer tried to pretend it was bigger than it actually was.
I said it at the time, and I believe it, that I think, in all seriousness, that, again, whether or not you voted for him or not, the president won the election. He was faced a lot of headwinds. And I think there was a faction of people out there that didn't want to give him the credit that he rightly deserved. And I think he takes a lot of that sometimes personally. Some of us who worked very hard to get him elected felt as though a lot of folks in the media in particular constantly sought to undermine the validity of that election. And so you have to understand it sometimes from that perspective.
But the validity of the election, compared to looking at photos of the crowd at an inauguration, I mean, they're like, one's this and one is this. Did you try to talk him out of that line of defense?
I think we, you know, there was a lot of us that wanted to be focused on his agenda, what he spoke about in his inaugural address. So, you know, look, but he's president. He made a decision.
So you have to go along. Even if you know, and I'm going to ask you to say whether it was or not, but even if you know the crowd wasn't bigger, you have to go, as press secretary, you have to say that it was.
Look, your job as press secretary is to represent the president's voice and to make sure that you are articulating what he believes.
Michael, remind us about that controversy, the photographs.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump had instructed his poor man, Sean Spicer, to go out in front of a fairly hungry press shortly after the election and tell them that we had seen the greatest crowd of an inauguration in decades, if not ever, I think, as far as I can remember. In that instant, you just had to feel sorry for a man who was given a baptism of fire and subsequently went on to have one of the most entertaining jobs I've seen in a long time.
Because if I remember, the President Barack Obama inauguration pictures showed much bigger crowds. But Spicer came across in even that brief clip with Jimmy Kimmel as far more considered and calm than most of the appearances we saw him give in the White House press room.
Well, it turned out that first address that he gave where he tried to defend those numbers that were clearly wrong, he'd only come in to set up his office that day. He wasn't wearing his proper suit and he just got thrown out to the hungry media. You know, it was funny to see him as a human being for the first time and not just as what I always found was quite satirical. You know, that, but he was still trying to toe the line of not saying anything that would offend the president, you know, saying that all I was paid to share his views, but wouldn't confirm or deny if he agreed with those views or realised that the numbers he was giving out about the inauguration that day were totally wrong.
Of course, there was lots more. He was found hiding in the bushes at one stage, I think, wasn't he, outside the press room when there was one particular controversy broke. Now, let's talk cats and dogs. First of all, Michael, tell us about the man who taught his dog Nazi salutes.
Yeah, okay, to begin with, this is a very strange story that appeared in the Metro in London. It started off as an inside joke between a couple where the boyfriend trained the dog to give Nazi salutes. And it ended up snowballing into something much bigger than they initially expected.
Yeah, why did he do that?
He said just to he maintained he wanted to play a joke on his girlfriend, but he maintained that it never would have gotten the attention that it did get. But you have to wonder if you're going to video your dog giving Nazi salutes and then put it on the internet, it's probably going to get some pickup.
Helen, the consequences for him have been?
Well, now he's unable to work apparently because I guess he's got such a bad name. But it's just like, don't be silly. Come on, you know not to do that and then put it on the internet and not expect people to find it. You know, it went viral. I don't know how many hits or how many people viewed it, but there's a legal case going on, which is still ongoing. And I think he's not working as a result of it. I don't have any sympathy. You're an idiot. And you piss off.
Tell us about the study, and I'll start with you in this one, Helen, that suggests that lonely cat hoarders are more likely to be unmarried women. Says who?
Says this study of 33 people, which I don't know.
That's a rather small study.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist, but I don't think that counts as a scientific study. But they found between 33 people, they had 915 dogs, 382 cats and 50 ducks. But 75% of the group were women. And I think they were women 61 plus. But they had 915 dogs and 382 cats. So why are they crazy old cat ladies? They're crazy old dog ladies.
Well, in fairness, it has to be said, dogs are much better company than cats anyway.
I'd agree with that.
That opinion will split us down the line, I'm afraid. But it was a really interesting study. It was carried out by a Brazilian university. And while the Daily Mail did focus on the fact that we've got cats and dogs like no tomorrow and we've old cat ladies roaming the streets, they did actually go for a more important tip-off on it. They wanted to prove something called animal hoarding disorder, which has been defined as a disorder where it stipulates that the owner had more animals than they could competently take care of, which obviously, when you have 33 people and 915 dogs and 382 cats, you could probably argue that that was the case in those.
But doesn't that mean that they had 30 dogs each or something? Like, I just don't think this makes any sense.
That you're running kennels effectively out the back.
And they're trying to claim that that's unsustainable, which I would agree. I don't know. I remember we were looking after four dogs at once and I found that incredibly difficult between two of us. I don't know how 60 plus year old women are looking after 27 dogs plus 382 cats, 10 cats each as well.
And a few ducks thrown in as well. Thank you very much, Helen Vaughan and Michael Cogley from the Ireland edition of The Times.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.